You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
This episode of Off Book is presented by MCC Theater's production of C.A. Johnson's All the Natalie Portmans. It's starring some of my favorite actors, Kara Young, Renika Williams, Montego Glover, Joshua Boone, just to name a few. Come and get you some of this Black excellence on stage at MCC. The show closes March 29th and tickets are available at mcctheater.org. That's mcctheater.org. Get your tickets now and see All the Natalie Portmans playing right now at MCC Theater. You don't want to miss it.
All right, it's that time. It's a brand new episode of Off Book presented to you by Broadway Black. We're ready to hit our marks and we're going to do it right now. I'm Kim Exum.
I'm York Walker.
I'm Ramaz Jamal.
And I'm C.A. Johnson.
Yes, we have a guest. So we're going to dig right in. Basically, just know that all of our weeks were great and fabulous. We don't really matter right now. It's all about Ms. Johnson here. Yes. So tell us about yourself.
About myself.
Yes.
Well, you know, I write plays.
Come on.
Or so they tell
me. Really?
Yeah. I was born and raised in and around New Orleans. I've been in New York for like 6 years now.
Okay.
Yeah, and the play, All the Natalie Portmans is set in D.C. So people are always like, what you know about D.C.? And I'm like, I actually finished high school in D.C.
Oh, wow. Like D.C. proper?
D.C. proper, yeah. I ended up there after Katrina. Yeah,
okay.
And I stayed. So the play is weirdly, like a lot of the family stuff is my stuff from back home. But a lot of the sort of location and the lingo and sort of what they're dealing with is all DC all day.
Come on. So you got the DC slang in there and the Mo and the, I'm from Baltimore, so it's totally, it's like two different languages. But when I went to college in Virginia, it was so many DC, Northern Virginia people and they all talk like in this weird Mo and what's
Mo,
the other stuff
Young.
That you say? Young.
And the play has a few, like somebody says something about Sison. Somebody says something about, what do we have? Cause I had to like layer it all in later. Cause it's like, at first I just had to get it out.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, now I have to make sure I'm in region.
Mm-hmm.
Like at one point, I think Kara's character says kill, which I hadn't
kill
heard in
Mo.
Years. Kill Mo.
What is Mo? This is new to me.
It's kind of Mo.
It's like nigga, yo.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
got it.
Yeah.
These joints.
Joints. DC is so weird.
So weird. And it's so crazy because, the actors are kind of from all over, but Josh Boone, who plays Samuel in the play, is from the RVA area.
Yeah, we went to college together.
Yeah, so he has it all in hand. And when he showed up for his audition, I remember I was like, okay, we good.
Right.
I was like, we have an anchor.
And there it
who
is.
Who can just slip right in. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So you say you've been in New York for 6 years. So did you move here from D.C.?
I did, okay. Yeah. So post-college, I went back to D.C. to teach writing. So I was teaching at my former high school. I went to Duke Ellington School of Arts in D.C.
Okay.
So I was teaching creative writing at the high school level, which I loved. I'm not going to lie. That was one of the best jobs I've ever had.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was so invested in those kids that I didn't write a thing.
Oh.
I would be like, I need to work on my play, but I have to help Michael with his. I was so invested in them that I could not invest in myself. So I was like, I got to get out of here. But I also didn't know how to do it because I was broke as a joke and I don't have the kind of family you can call home and say, hey, Ma, send me a few bucks.
Right.
So I was like, let me just apply to grad schools and hope somebody gives me a lot of money to do it. And I got a lot of no's, but NYU was like, yes. And also, here's the money.
Wow. Come on, NYU.
Yeah.
So. NYU be coming through on the low. I just read an interview with of Michael R. Jackson, Strange Loop, and he was talking about his experience with applying to undergraduate and graduate programs and how he essentially got no's. And NYU was like, yeah, like mm-hmm. come on down. Mm-hmm.
They progressive over there.
They do. No, I didn't get in, but you know, it's fine.
But it's crazy. I remember my year in grad school, you know, they don't publish any of it, but I remember slowly we started to realize the people who had full rides mm-hmm. and there were a decent chunk of us.
That's amazing.
And I was like, okay, so they're actually doing something with all this money they're sitting on. You know what I mean? And like a decent chunk of those are women and people of color, which I also thought was dope. I was like, okay.
That is dope.
Okay, like they're trying to do something.
There's a myth about NYU that they don't give nobody money and you just gonna be in debt.
I have a feeling that really, that's about like undergrad drama. Okay. I think a lot of the conversation is about undergrad drama.
Okay. Yeah.
And I don't know that for a fact, but I will say this. I remember my graduation, and when they said every program, they would be like, graduate acting, graduate this and that. Mm-hmm. And you would see like small groups of people stand up, and they were like undergraduate drama, and the whole bottom floor stood up, and I was like, that can't be legal. I was like, this can't, like,
because they have so many different schools there. Yeah. Like,
and I was like, not all those kids are going to be actors. Like, I mean, more power to every single person. Absolutely. But also not all of them are going to make it. And how much money did you just drain out?
Too much. It's like, what, $60,000 a year now?
Crazy.
It's ridiculous. But you know, part of the journey.
Of the journey.
It is. I love. When did you graduate from Duke Ellington?
I graduated in 08.
Oh, wait. Did you know Keziah?
Yes.
I work with Keziah. Yeah. I love her.
She was 2 years behind me.
Okay.
Yeah. I love Keziah.
I always be forgetting like how much older I am than Keziah at work. I mean, I'm not that much older than her, but like I graduated high school in 06. Mm-hmm. And like, I just be forgetting. I don't know, you working with people, you just kind of forget. Yeah. Like, you know, we're working with 50-year-old people and 22-year-old people and 30-some-year-old people, but you're all there together. So you kind of like...
It all evens out.
It all kind of evens out. But yeah, I love her. We share like the whole... I remember we were at work singing the Shoe City commercial. You wouldn't know unless you were from the area.
Yes. Yes.
It was a nice moment. It was like, your city, my city, Shoe City.
Oh, my God. I haven't heard that in a long time.
Four to four, yet it gets tight. Check it right, Shoe City. That's right.
I love it.
Ratchet. Right. They be selling up in there.
Shoes!
It's just shoes.
Oh, just
shoes. It's called Shoe City. They sell shoes.
Because you know, when it be them ghetto store, they sell a little bit of everything.
Now I think in like a downtown locker room type of situation where they sell like, you know, clothes and stuff. I think they always sold clothes, but the focus was on shoes.
Yeah, you went there for shoes.
You went there for shoes. Okay. Because it's called Shoe City.
They knew what they was doing. I have a question. What is your process as a writer? Mm. And sort of, I was wondering if you could speak to like where the, idea for this show came from.
Yeah. My process is weird. I mean, my process is sort of born out of the people who taught me. So, in grad school, I got taught by this playwright, Eduardo Machado, who is this crazy Cuban dude, but he's brilliant. And he's not there to teach you how to write a play. He's just there to teach you how to write every day. Mm. And so the way he taught us involved a lot of meditation and sort of like body work. And so once you sort of centered yourself, then you found the character and then you let the character speak.
Wow.
And a lot of people didn't like it. I loved it because it quieted my mind because my mind can be busy. Mm. So I try to do that in the way that I work. I'm not one of those people who like writes every day at the same time. I write in like, I'll do like 2 weeks of writing intensely and I'm like, there's a draft, and then I'll write for weeks.
Do you like Jane the Virgin?
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. I love Jane. That's sort of like my process, I guess you could say, but with this play specifically, I started writing it in a writing group. So I was in like a writer's retreat at the Lark.
Okay.
And I was in that group with like Lucy Thurber and Chisa Hutchinson and Susan Stanton. It was like a good group, like a diverse group of people all in one room.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us knew what we wanted to work on, so we all just sort of tried something. And I started with these little monologues where it was just like this girl monologuing about movie stars, which was just me pulling from my own childhood. I've always been obsessed with actresses. in kind of a crazy way and in an obsessive way, that when I was young was cute and then after a while was weird. Right. And like the more I wrote those little monologues, the more I got to know the character, I was like, oh, I think I'm trying to say something about that journey for myself.
Yeah.
And then I had to figure out like how her journey was different than mine. But, you know, it was like the play wound up being this sort of play with a girl in the center who loves a thing, but her life around her is really, really, really complicated. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't have money. They can barely pay the rent. Her mom is an alcoholic. There's a lot going on. And I think I was trying to write about, you know, some impoverished Black families where, like, there is so much hanging over them, but they still find a way to love each other through all the bad, and they find a way to have dreams.
Yeah.
And this kid has, like, glommed on to movie stars. Mm. And, like, it's beautiful at first, but after a while, you're like, this actually might not be healthy. Huh. Like, it's okay to want dreams, but your dreams should be connected to people who look like you. Mm-hmm. Your dreams should be connected to, like, as much as they're connected to the things that you want to do, they have to be connected to your roots and your Blackness and the fact that that is beautiful. And this kid is trying to find that but hasn't found it yet. Inside a family that's given her time, right?
Yeah.
But sort of the pressures of the play sort of ask her, like, but who are you? Who are you? Who are you outside of all that madness?
This sort of reminds me of not as oftenly done as A Funny House in a Negro, but Adrian Kenyon play called Movie Star Must Star in Black and White.
It's one of my favorite plays.
Man, so yeah.
Top five.
So basically in that narrative, the lead, I would say, is envisioning their life story, but told through like popular white movie stars in the 40s and the 50s.
That sounds so like I would love it.
It's so good.
Beautiful play, but it's very satirical in a way because she's imagining her Black family and her personal story through white people.
Mm-hmm. What's the name of that again? Let me write that down.
Star
in Black and White.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Adrian Kenyon.
It's so good.
I recently did it this fall.
Really?
Paired with Funny House of a Negro. I always get kind of like asked to do these satires, which I love it. I really love it.
I'm kind of obsessed with the idea of that because like one of my favorite plays is a Clifford Odets piece called The Big Night.
Oh, I love that play too.
And I love old Hollywood and I love old movies and the glamour of it. And I've always been kind of obsessed with that era ever since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know why. Like one of my favorite movies growing up was The Wizard of Oz. And so that kind of segued into a Judy Garland thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then like I had a copy of The Wizard of Oz on VHS at every home that I stayed at. So my daddy's house, my mom's house, my nana's house, they all had their own little copies. Mm-hmm. Like it was such a thing. So I think that I will really, cause I love the glamour and I love like the look of it and the way films were made.
Yeah.
And just, I don't know. It's so different than today.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, you look at those things and then you think about, like, the historical context
yes.
of, like, what was actually happening with us and how I have the same feeling about things like period pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I would love to be in, like, a period piece where I'm, like, in this tight-ass corset. Like, darling, I don't understand, like, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's just not realistic because I'm not white.
Yeah.
You know, so there's kind of this yearning to like want to be in that world and you kind of can't.
Yeah.
Well, and it's sort of like I say this all the time. Black people, frankly, any person of color, like we grew up watching people who weren't like us and because we are amazing, we were like that could be me.
Yep.
Like you don't see the difference at first because you're just like, it's a good story. Like,
yeah.
We can see any story and we know if it's good, we know if it's beautiful, we know if it's bad.
Right.
And like, it's something I think is actually kind of wonderful about us and about what we're capable of. And it's so funny to me when white people will be like, I can't find my way into this play.
Yeah.
I don't know if that show was for me. And I'm like, it's for everybody. Isn't that hard for you to just be able to see everybody?
Right.
And we are good at it. We're real good at it.
Oh, because
we didn't have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's crazy to me. I can't find myself into this play. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about?
What are you talking about?
I done found myself into, you know, Hello Dolly.
I love Hello Dolly.
Me too.
I love Hello Dolly.
Me too. Everybody was like, it's so boring. I was like, I love it. I love Oklahoma. I be loving all that little old racist. People were like, oh my God, I hated Carousel. I was like, I thought it was beautiful.
It was beautiful.
The casting didn't make any sense, but
but they were so good.
They were good. In the dance, the choreography. Mm. Child, I love me some old racist white people theater.
That's hilarious. What else?
So cool. Could you tell us about the process with the director? Can you speak about that?
Yeah. So Kate, how did I find Kate? So my director on this play is Kate Wariski. This play I wrote like kind of in a corner by myself, and I didn't really let a lot of people read it. I have a lot of other plays that like I had done public readings of and like had directors come listen to, but this play was so close to home that I just didn't show it to anybody. Mm-hmm. And I was working on a different play in a fellowship that was run by Diana Sun, the playwright, and she would invite guests in to hear it, and she invited Kate in, and apparently she told Kate, there's a writer you should know, I won't tell you who it is. And so she came through and she heard all our work and she was looking at me crazy. And I remember afterwards, Diana sent me an email being like, Kate would like to have your email. Can I send it? And I said, sure. And I remember we met in Brooklyn to just have a coffee. And I remember thinking like, this woman is much further ahead of me in career. I don't know if I want this play to be directed by a white woman. That's something I have to think through. Mm-hmm. Her track record is nice because she's worked with Julia Cho and Lynn Nottage and Christina Anderson. Like she's done the stuff with the people, but you know, we're asking some good industry questions right now about what that looks like and who should have access to our stories. So I went in like, guard up and was like excited to know her, but I was like, I don't know.
Yeah. And she also has like quite a history of like doing like black narratives. Just kind of read some of their off Broadway credits. She's done Ruined at the Manhattan Theater Club, also did Fabulation at Playwrights Horizon. And what's the other one?
She did Sweat.
Sweat. There we go. That's what I was looking
She did
for.
Sweat on Broadway.
Yeah, and
she works with Lynn a lot.
She, they work together a lot. And I remember, I swear, I went in like, I don't know. And then we talked, we talked for 3 hours.
Wow.
3 hours about like parenting and like growing up Poe and like all this stuff. And I was like, oh, this is a mind meld thing. And I don't know what we might work on together, but I remember this meeting. And then when I had been working on the play for a little bit longer, it got into the Sundance Theater Lab, and they, because of their clout, they say, who do you want to work with? We can ask anybody because we're Sundance. And I was like, I don't know. I guess we can ask that lady. And we.
So what was the change of heart? Because me as a designer, I'm not too familiar with your play, but it's black leads, it's queer, and like you have like this this new narrative that's driven by that. And so me, I'm usually kind of nervous about like how I was saying that I did A Movie Star Must Be Filming Black and White, Funny House of Negro. That was directed by a white woman. And I was like,
ooh, that's interesting.
I really want to do this play, but what is this? Why is she so eager to do this? And I was like, man, there was points where I wanted to like, you know, fade out and be like, nah, this is not for me. This is not the kind of thing I want to do. And plus, it was just me giving it an opportunity for the first time to work with someone who was white, because I have a history of working on black narratives black directors. And I don't know. It's just
complicated.
It's very complicated. And like, I feel kind of forced to stay because like me as a costume designer, I'm the character designer. And so the whole team and, you know, the actors are relying on me to bring the authenticity despite, you know, I'm the only black person on the creative team, but I have that responsibility to make it happen. And so I was like, let me go ahead and stay and push it through and, you know, make this the best experience possible. But could you kind of speak to like what was your change of heart?
Yeah. You know, I think for me, at the end of the day, I was like, okay, so Kate and I just did an entire workshop together where she helped me see what was wrong with my play in a way that I hadn't been able to find on my own. And we had such a shorthand. And her way of working was never to tell me what my work was or to try to name black things for me. Like she would be like, here's what I know about these three things. And there are four things over there that only you can name, and I'm going to wait for you to name them. Oh, wow. And you let me know when you're ready. She has such a skill set of having worked with artists who have a completely different worldview than her, and such a respect for their worldview that she does not step on things.
That's mm-hmm. incredible.
And when she weirdly gets something wrong, nobody feels uncomfortable about saying it. Like, there was one moment when we had something on set and Josh Boone was like, uh-uh. Like, I don't even remember what it was, but he pointed at it, and like, what was underneath that uh-uh was, "That ain't black." And then she was like, "Get it out of here." Mm-hmm. And like, for her, there's no ego. There's no, mm-hmm. and I'm telling you, it was such a question for me. And I had to, at the end of the day, be like, okay, for me, what is the thing I care about most when it comes to this play and it being articulated the way I needed to be articulated on stage? Mm-hmm. And for me, it was that, like, I write dialogue in a very specific way. Mm-hmm. My characters say a lot really intensely. Mm-hmm. And I need somebody who will never, ever, 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 ever go past a beat. Ever. We'll never run over something. We'll never overdo it. We'll never. And Kate is the kind of director who will spend 1 hour on one line because she wants to do what I wrote.
Wow.
And she's so diligent and so tedious. And I could breathe. I feel like so often when I work with directors, I feel like I'm constantly having to be like, there's so much about this world that you get, except that you're not getting my language.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's the one fight I'm not good at having because it's too emotional for me. Yeah. And I really liked that I could let go when I was working with her, and I mm-hmm. could be like, okay, so I trust you to deal with all the language, and all these other things I can deal with. So like, when there's something that we're trying to articulate that is dangerous and personal to the actors, right? Like, I got black people in some complicated situations in this play. Yeah. And so when we had moments where the actors were like, I feel you and I'm trying to get there, and Kate's trying to help them, I'd be like, I got it. Mm-hmm. And then we would have a conversation, and she could respect that, and she would just go quiet.
And that's like the great mm-hmm. thing about new plays, when, you know, the living playwright is there and
totally.
Accessible.
Yeah.
Which I think
to,
is different.
Doing, you know, somebody
if they're
who's
dead
deceased.
Or if Adrian Kenny, who is like very old and yeah. not, you yeah, know, accessible, it kind of make the process difficult for some people if you don't have that healthy balance on the creative team.
Yeah. I would have felt probably the opposite if I knew I wasn't going to be in the room.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm
yeah.
being honest, I would have mm-hmm. been like, no, thank you. I love you. We right. need to find somebody who I know can watch the things that I would be watching if mm-hmm. I were in the room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I do have a question for you before we're going to ask a question that was actually asked of you at the panel.
Mm-hmm.
But my own personal question, how is it for you as a black woman writing characters that aren't woman and aren't black?
Mm.
Because I find like a lot of white, and I'm a advocate of a writer should be able to write mm-hmm. freely. You know, you don't have to write what you know, especially when you're experienced and mm-hmm. you're trained. But I know that a lot of white playwrights and white writers have kind of obsessions with going into the psyche of black characters, and sometimes it's inaccurate. So when you're writing someone of a different race, like mm-hmm. what is your process through that? Or do you feel comfortable doing that? Or mm-hmm. does it come naturally? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I will say that I feel very comfortable writing white characters because I feel like whiteness is something we've had to swallow our whole lives. So I don't feel a lot of fear there. I feel like I'll get the first gesture of the white person out, and then I'll go back and be like, make sure you were nice to them because they are your character. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Make sure the character is doing what they need to do for the play to be sound. You know yeah. what I mean? Because the first pass is always, I find, a little harsh. Mm-hmm. And then I have to go back in and be like, all right, what does the story need? And what do we like? I have one play that's like six characters, and it's five black people and one white woman. And from very on in the play, it becomes very clear that this white woman is going to die. Mm-hmm. And like, those are the stakes of the world, and I don't apologize for the stakes of the world. But some of the writing, some of the work I had to do when I was editing it was being like, give the woman a chance. She gonna die, but just give her a little time so people understand her point of view. And I was like, okay, so that's the work I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
I am not as casual with other folks of color.
Okay.
Just because I'll be like, there are things I know and there are things that I don't know. Because I actually, their cultures have been as marginalized as my own. So I like to check in with people. I have a play, a commission that I need to work on. You know, New Orleans has a huge Vietnamese population. And when I was growing up, all the corner stores were owned by Vietnamese folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm writing a story set in one of those. And it's like a love story between a black woman in her 60s and this Vietnamese man in his 60s. And it's a weird idea that I came up with, but just based on stories from my childhood. And I was like, okay, I want to do this. But it is much harder to write than any of the other stuff I've written because it's just not my culture and I need to not mess it up.
Mm.
I gotcha.
But I actually think it's not hard if you're willing to do the work. I think the problem is sometimes white folks are like, I want to write about this other character, these people who aren't me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes men are like, I want to write about this gender who that's not mine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to actually do the work to get it right. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. they're like, I know it. And I'm like, sometimes we know it and sometimes we don't. Right. And it's like figuring out what you're good at. I think I actually think my favorite character, if I'm being honest, my favorite characters to write are black men. Mm-hmm. Because I love them so much. I have three brothers and I just like, I see it and I get it. And I feel like sometimes the representations mm-hmm. of black men can be so, I don't know, like lopsided. They're angry or they're this or they're that. And mm-hmm. like black men are all the colors. And I like mm-hmm. being able to play with all those colors and give them the same range that white men have gotten on stage since the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm. Talk about it.
Yeah. That's incredible. Going back to the panel mm-hmm. discussion, which our own Yan Field Stewart mm-hmm. moderated.
Hey.
the question that she asked was, what is your opinion of the representation of black queer women in the contemporary American theater? I am also interested in your feelings about the symbiotic or not relationship between black queer women and black queer men in the American theater.
Yes. I remember this question.
That's a question.
I looked at Ian like, for real, we doing this? We doing this here?
And she's always like, we're always doing this.
She was proud of that question. I think for me, like, the simplest answer is that the representation of black queer women on the American stage is abysmal. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a viewpoint and a type of person that has been overlooked for a long time. I think that it's sad that I spent the early part of my career trying to find elders, knowing that they probably existed, but they had just never been prized by the institutions. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, there's Lorraine, but even the play of hers that we celebrate the most ain't the one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I do think we're in a moment right now where there are more stories happening. Like, I think it's exciting that my play was up at the same time as Danetta Lavinia Gray's. I think, like, there are other, like, Tiny Barfield, mm-hmm. Bright Half-Life. That's a beautiful play. Like, there are these examples, but to find my voice, I had to basically try to, like, put together a puzzle that was like, okay, August Wilson here, mm-hmm. Lorraine Hansberry here, and then I add in, like, Lisa Crone and Paula Vogel, because at least they have that other piece of my identity. Right. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I was trying to put together, like, a puzzle of who I am through a lot of writers who literally weren't doing the thing that I'm trying to do, mm-hmm. and it shouldn't be that hard, and right. it's only that hard because theatrical institutions for a very long time have not valued us. I feel like the first few years of my career, I could send my play in and somebody would go, we love this play. And then they would go, we're not going to produce it. Mm-hmm. And then I would say, okay, what was that space between we love it and we're not going to produce it? Mm-hmm. Not because I think I'm God's gift.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But because I want to know what that is. And what right. it is like in that space, they decide that my story doesn't have value. Mm-hmm. And that other stories do. And that's not about me, and that's not about the people I'm trying to write. That's about white institutions not knowing where to put black queer women.
Ooh.
Who are these plays for? And I'm like, well, women,
uh-huh.
well, queer people, mm-hmm. well, anybody who's ever felt marginalized and who's felt desire that they didn't know if they were allowed to feel. Mm-hmm. Like, that yes. is universal.
Right.
Every person has felt that. The first time you feel desire, it is actually terrifying. And it yeah. doesn't matter if you're queer or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's always this conversation about, like, if black queer women are being produced as much as black queer men. And for me, black queer men were, like, my first friends in the theater. Like, my first big fellowship in the city I had with Donye Love.
Mm-hmm.
And Donye is, like, I call him my brother. I love him so much. And we were writing plays that were weirdly in conversation. And we would go have cupcakes and talk about it. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, same with, like, Michael R. Jackson. I've known Jeremy for a long time. Like, I don't have beef with black queer men. Mm-hmm. I actually want to see their work produced and I want to celebrate them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have beef with an institution that basically has me in one hand and them in another hand and says that only one of us can fit.
Right.
Right.
And that's not about black people, and it's not fair of them to pit great black artists against one another in that way, because that's just some white institutional BS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like yes, historically, there's been far more representation of black queer men, but I actually think that that's because of patriarchy. It's because...
No, because they have the men thing.
Yeah, and it's easier for a theater. It's easier for a white gay man. Let's be honest. That's most of it. It's easier for a white gay man to say, well, I understand him. I don't know what she's talking about.
Right. Yeah.
Like, that's just easier, and that's just prejudice. Mm. But for feel like if we have an institutional issue, it's because of institutions. It's not because of us. Like, I have so much love for the black queer men who are writing and who honestly are killing it. So I'm like, yes, I think there's a problem, but I don't think it's a black problem.
Come on now.
Because they created it. Let them fix it.
Mm-hmm. Come on now. This episode of Off Book, brought to you by Broadway Black, is sponsored by all the Natalie Portmans, a fantastical new coming of age story about a smart and hyper imaginative queer teenager named Kiana. The New York Times called out Carrie Young's portrayal of Kiana as a restless, vital performance with a mountain of heart. It is playing at the MCC Theater on 52nd Street in Hell's Kitchen, and it must close by March 29th. So please get your tickets now. And it's also written by the fabulous C.A. Johnson in her off-Broadway debut. Please catch this play and this playwright's work before it hits an even bigger stage and it's completely sold out and you can never see it ever.
Should we go into some of these hot topics?
Yes, I'm so excited.
You're going to do the little...
Hot topics.
Come on. That's right. So there's a couple of things happening. Where we want to start? We want to build up.
Well, we already started talking about Jeremy. You want to build
up? We did start talking about Jeremy.
All right.
Well, so we can just hop on into that.
We can. Jeremy O'Harris has a development deal with HBO. He is currently a co-producer on the show Euphoria. And now he's in a development deal, kind of developing, I think it said, his graduate thesis project into something for the screen. I want to start by saying congratulations, Mr. Harris.
That's amazing.
I think that all his accomplishments are great. I do find him to be a very problematic person in the theater as a black woman, but I do think that his voice is valid.
Yeah.
I will say that. I think his voice is valid. I think it's necessary. I think that it's dope that, you know, he's going to be able to develop work. You know, hopefully it's for the culture. Slave play for me as a black woman watching essentially a rape on stage, it literally gave me a panic attack, which is not a reaction that I think is beneficial. I felt very violated that work by a queer black man was kind of made on the back of my body without my consent, meaning like as a black woman.
Right.
And that's the main problem that I had with that work. And just the white gaze that I find his work to have. That's my issue. I didn't know anything about slave play when I went to go see it. But once I got into the theater, I mean, of course I was very uncomfortable in the first act. The second act was just giving me information as a person from an urban community, a black person who grew up in a Baltimore community, that all of my artistic ideas are of blackness, not white centered at all. He was just telling me shit that I already knew.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And it kind of made me feel like, well, fuck these white people for real. Like, it didn't make me, cause I'm used to like, I was like, is he gonna make me want to be friends with these motherfuckers afterwards? Or, or am I just supposed to like go and burn the country down? Like, that's what I felt like the second I was for, but I was like, all right, I'm here for it. It's smart. It's very smart. And then third act, you know, I just felt like, now I don't know what his writing process was, but I feel like, I'm like, I don't know what black woman you talk to, but it sure wasn't none of my friends. No black woman that I know. It was very offensive to me. Very offensive to me. Very offensive to a lot of women I know. I do know a lot of people who loved it. Actually, most of the people that I know who loved it were black gay men. You know, but I guess I'm just tired of like black female bodies being represented in this overtly sexual way that also is like filled with, and it doesn't even have to be overtly, the sexual thing doesn't matter. It just feels like it's without my consent. Very like Tyler Perry-esque, you know, like how he's always centering the black woman, but he's giving her like AIDS or an attitude problem or a husband that beats the shit out of her. Mm-hmm. And it's like surface level trying to be deep, but it's no woman that I actually know. Mm-hmm. And I know that the whole thing is made up. And da da da. But anyway, let me get off my soapbox. Congratulations to him.
Yeah. That's that. You know, that's.
Anyway, that's on that.
That's valid.
Beautiful gowns.
Oh my God.
Anybody else want to weigh in on Anybody else have thoughts?
Somebody add something positive. Come on. Give me some.
Well, I think it's always positive when a black artist is being given a deal like that. Like, yes. HBO is a big deal.
It is a big deal.
I mean, Euphoria was a breakout hit last year. And yeah. It was, I'm not going to lie, I watched that every week because I was like, what is happening? Mm-hmm. What is now? Who is this?
Right.
I mean, I watched all of it. And it was mm-hmm. exciting that at the end of every episode, I saw his name. And yeah. I thought, mm-hmm. I know that dude. And I work in TV. So like, I know, my name has been up there and I still was like, I know him. You know, cause it never gets old to see a black artist thriving. Like, I'm always like, yes, absolutely. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And he's got that new movie that was like a hit at Sundance.
Now that I really want to see.
Ooh, cause I remember that Twitter thread.
Yes. Now I must say, like I said, like his work is smart. Mm-hmm. His work is smart. He's yeah. smart. He's real smart.
He's a good writer.
He's mm-hmm. a good writer.
He writes.
And mm-hmm. I want to see his work progress.
Yeah.
But I kind of have the same attitude with him now because I've only seen one piece of his work
mm-hmm. right.
that I do with Tyler Perry. And I'm sorry, Mr. Harris, for comparing you to Mr. Perry, but I will always watch Mr. Perry's work.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
Mm-hmm. I was raised on Mr. Perry.
I was raised on
I watched him on the stage.
And yeah. Same.
On the stage
and
with
he
family.
He was actually yeah. really brilliant live. Mm-hmm. But you know, but it's extremely problematic work and I am very much offended by it. But I do have an appreciation for it because I do think it's important. It's an important voice, even if I don't like the voice.
Right.
And I need to keep watching it in order to expand my mind and my thoughts on either, hey, why don't I like this work?
Right.
Or why do I like this over this?
Mm-hmm.
Like my recent thing with Jeremy Harris was like, oh, there's a sexual scene in Slave Play that I'm very offended by to the point I had a visceral reaction, a physical reaction to it. But then in A Strange Loop, which also has a very sexual scene
yeah.
that is also offensive. And I had to kind of dissect within myself, like, why am I so offended by this and not by this? And I came up with my own answers because mm-hmm. like Strange Loop uses black bodies only exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mm-hmm. Slave Play uses both white
right.
and, you know, and also the point that like I'm a woman. And so my identity is wrapped up more so in Slave Play than it is in A Strange Loop where I can relate to the story,
right.
but I'm not centered in the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not being dragged through the story.
Right.
You know, but anyway, yes, like I'm excited for his progression. I
yeah.
really am, but I just don't want to be, I don't want
to
be right.
And I think it's important to be able to create space mm-hmm. to have critique.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're just now coming into a place, especially with, you know, film and TV. And I saw The Photograph a couple of weeks ago, the mm-hmm. Issa Rae movie.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah.
And it was like getting dragged on Twitter. And I was like, I mean, it's like, it's a good movie, but it's not. There's nothing bad in it. I think people were like, oh, it's boring. And you're like, as a writer looking at it, I'm like, oh, we could have raised the stakes here. Mm-hmm. We could have fought for the love a little mm-hmm. more here. But it was mm-hmm. nothing that we need to drag it. Like, it's a good.
Well, but you know what I said? I've been saying this recently a lot. And it's like, we're entering a new phase where we have a lot more options than what we get to watch.
Right.
And just
yeah.
because because something doesn't resonate with us doesn't mean, like, and like, if something doesn't resonate with you for political reasons that have to do with your identity and you need to speak to that all day, every day. You
right.
know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think like, if you don't like it, you just don't like it.
Right.
And like, how amazing is it that we can just be like, I think I don't like this.
Right.
Yes, there's enough
yes.
black work out here that we don't mm-hmm. have to stand
so watch
for.
What you
and
like.
That's new. And that's new for us.
I love that.
And I think this is just part of the,
make
the growing
me hate
pains
you.
Of like, having representation.
Totally.
It's like, oh, so wait, so I don't have to stand for that
no.
over there just mm-hmm. because it's black?
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't stand for it, we won't get no more. It's like, oh, we're going to have mm-hmm. content.
Yes.
It's an exciting place to be, but I just feel like the Twitter culture and we're so quick to cancel each other out
yeah.
for our opinions,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially with these movies. That happened with Queen and Slim. It was like mm-hmm. some
yeah.
people
I didn't
loved
see it.
Queen and Slim.
Mm-hmm.
Some people hated Queen and Slim. And I think both opinions are valid because, you know, what my personal experience watching Queen and Slim might be different from someone else's. You know, you got Moonlight. Moonlight rocked me in a way I ain't been rocked by a movie.
Moonlight was something.
You know, and there are other people that are like, it was boring.
It was so good. It was beautiful.
Right? I had that with, I saw Beale Street and somebody was like, well, I didn't like that one. It wasn't as good as Moonlight. And I swear to you, like, it comes down to like what representation you're looking for.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, I loved Moonlight.
Yes.
Beale Street, because of the subject matter, I have two brothers who are incarcerated. Yeah. Because of the subject matter, that one
exactly
got up under my skin in a way that I was like, I've never gotten over. There's like a final scene in that where she comes to tell him she couldn't do it. Like, she couldn't do it. And you watch him take that in, and then he starts to take care of her.
Yeah.
And I was like, the number of times I've been in a phone conversation with my brother where I know that his life is so, like, I live a beautiful, like, beautiful, privileged life compared to how he lives. And he still is like, what do you need?
Right.
It's beautiful and heartbreaking. Right. You know what I mean? And I literally almost got up and walked out of the theater.
Yeah.
If you didn't like it, fine, but don't come for me.
Exactly.
Because I enjoyed myself.
Right. And we have to create space for everybody to have their opinions and their experiences, because it may not be your personal experience, but if it touched you, it touched you.
Well, that's why I think that all Black voices, especially like in the theater, in film, and even like, I mean, the crossover from, you know, playwrights getting into film, it's very important. And even if I don't necessarily agree with your voice or feel seen by your voice, I am going to psychoanalyze it within myself on the why. And then I'm going to ingest more of your work. Maybe not that same work ever again, but I'm going to ingest more of your work to see your growth, to see my growth, and also just the beauty of having such a bounty of, like, I didn't go see Queen and Slim because I didn't have to.
Right.
I was like, I don't really want to see this. I'm not interested in this movie. But 5 years ago, I would have just gone to see it because it's Black.
Right.
Like, now there's so many Black plays off Broadway. It's like, damn, I can sit here and literally choose. I don't have to go see all of them.
Yeah, it's like, am I in a mood for a comedy or a drama?
Yeah.
Let me pick one.
It's like, I don't want to see, I don't like romance. I don't want to see The Photograph. So I'm not going.
My perspective on this is that, like, I've always been trained to understand that there's this, like, this James Baldwin quote that basically says that theater is intended to disturb the peace. And so, like, my 3 years in grad school, I've always been trained to don't say that you like something. Don't say that you hate something after you read it or after you've seen it. Try to exercise your brain and think about, what is the playwright's intent? What did you get from it?
Yeah.
What do you wish that happened? And you know, if it's something political, it, you know, it sparks the conversation. And I think that's the beauty about theater. That's the thing that drew me into theater. Like, my theater 101 was the Color Museum, and that shit was radical. It was political. It was loud. It was crazy. I never seen no shit like that in my life. So when that was my theater 101. So ever since then, I'm like, man, I'm interested in theater that challenges my mind.
Yeah.
Whether I agree with it or I may be offended by it, but it always, in a way, as an artist, I'm always growing from it and asking questions.
Yeah.
And it helps create the future of, like, what do society need? What we don't need? What are people responding to? And that's how we can evolve in the industry if we do spit out these things. And I think it's great that we do have these options of things that's like, oh, I want to see Black people laugh. Mm-hmm. Oh, I want to see this tragedy. Oh, I want to watch this slave thing. You know, whatever it may be, we have a little bit of everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great that we're responding to it.
Oh, amen. Yeah. We have to go to a next hot topic because we got a long ass letter.
Or should we just jump to the letter?
Okay, we're good.
Okay.
So there's another hot topic. God, I'm not good at this. Where is Drew? Where's Drew?
You got it.
Get out the jail, Drew.
You got it.
Escape the green mile.
Break out.
Break out, Drew. Let's talk about something kind of cool. The Prince of Egypt in the West End.
Yes. Listen, okay, so I saw this clip yesterday on Lee Colston's Facebook. Shout out to Lee. You know, okay, so I just feel the Prince of Egypt, when the movie came out,
my church went.
It was a huge thing because it was brown people. Mm-hmm. The cartoon was brown.
Mm-hmm.
So then I click on the link for the YouTube clip of the cast singing Deliver Us. And it's all kinds of white folks singing Deliver Us. And it just, it was a little crunchy. It just was like, y'all know what movie this came from. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't, and then also like the sound of it to me, when I think of a song called Deliver Us Out of Slavery.
It's Harriet Tubman with the lantern.
It's Harriet Tubman with the lantern. Bringing it full circle with that lantern.
I cannot.
My name is Harriet Tubman and this is my light to freedom.
That's right. You. There's a specific sound that comes to mind and it ain't what I heard. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, why couldn't we just
first of all, why we couldn't just leave it as an animation? The animation was beautiful. It was gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was like full lips, the hair, the whole aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Like my thing is, if you're going to reproduce something, make that shit better. Like what the fuck you doing?
I mean, you should just post that in the middle of Times Square. Because no one has gotten that memo.
They truly haven't.
Except for maybe SpongeBob. I thoroughly enjoyed SpongeBob.
Oh, that was fine. You enjoyed it?
That was fire.
I missed it.
It was great.
I
was
fine.
And it had that woman in it whose voice is like a voice from the heavens.
Like it's...
What is her name?
She's not a child. She's a grown woman, but she's a baby in the business.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Jalen Justin.
Yes.
I went to see SpongeBob. Like, I was like, we'll see what this is. I like the show, so I don't need this. Also, why am I still watching SpongeBob? That's another conversation.
That's all right.
But I legitimately was like, we'll see. And then I was like, this is a whole other thing.
Mm.
And she came out, and I was like, this is, who is that?
Who exactly? We was in a program.
That woman can sing. I was like.
I cried during the Squidward tap number. Now, mind you, I just had a baby, and I was like. But that was like high concept, fun, mm-hmm. camp, kids.
And just good music.
Good music, mm-hmm. good ever. The costume,
and they took a risk.
They mm-hmm. took risks. The acting was good. It was so good. And then they had to close it because, but anyway.
But Prince of Egypt?
If you're going to make something, do it like SpongeBob is a template. I know that sounds crazy. I felt crazy saying it. But yeah, you're going to make Prince of Egypt, you got to make that shit better. Yeah.
I agree.
And they over here like. Singing like
this was just so it's just real. It just seemed
they may be delivered from Caucasia.
And
then it seemed like the costumes was like very contemporary in a way, which is like, how are you fucking up the beauty of ancient
it's
Egypt?
Very like
what
it's,
are you
it's
doing?
Very influencer.
But also, this is it's Egypt.
Come on.
Find some Egyptians.
Talk about that's what
you,
why I look
yeah,
like,
you in the UK.
Kanye West
Y'all not that far.
Clothing line?
Yeezy. It does look like Yeezy.
That's what the fuck it look like.
It looks like Yeezy.
I'm done.
Deliver us from... Actually, they should have just hired his choir to do the Prince of Egypt.
And it was
Sunday service.
I mean, I know that Kanye is canceled or whatever, but they sound real good, y'all. And
you see the one where Sia sang?
No. Mm-mm.
They were doing a version... Find this clip. It was Sunday service, and they were doing a version of one of her songs, and it was just the choir, and then the choir called to Sia, like, girl, come out here. Mm-hmm. So then Sia was in the middle of them singing, and they were all like, you better sing. She was singing.
Listen, that's what y'all
got me.
Just revamp the whole show. Get the Sunday service. Mm-hmm. Or Kanye just steal the idea because he'd be doing operas now. I don't know how he's qualified to do that, but whatever.
He don't know.
So confused
he'd be doing operas.
Music, so.
Nebuchadnezzar the opera, starring like random rapper.
You know,
he can do the Prince of Egypt, and I'm sure I'd love to see it.
Mm-hmm. It would be well produced.
It would. It would be well produced, and nobody would be.
What?
They would be white.
Oh, we don't know.
They would be white.
No, we can go that far.
Nobody would be. It wouldn't sound.
That's true. Right. Mm-hmm. That's true.
It would sound,
he is going for an authentic sound.
Yes.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
So we should
speaking of opera. You're gonna jump.
Yeah.
Into this
let's jump into this. Now this is a long letter.
It's an essay. It's a
There's a lot of details. I'm going to try. To articulate and get through it with some alacrity, because we're going to be here all day. All right. So it.
Back up. Alacrity. I felt assaulted by your vocabulary.
All right. Here we go. Where did I want to start this? Okay. In late July of 2019, a fairly successful black opera singer posted a Facebook rant that was sent to me by another singer colleague in the business. The post was an incredibly triggering picture collage of white folks in minstrel blackface. Think Al Jolson blackface. Mm. Imagine six or so pictures of black painted faces. The lips were drawn to quadruple the size. The coonish grin that we've come used to seeing as textbook examples of blackface. The first line of the post was, "This is blackface." The singer went on to loudly exclaim, claim that these photographs were the real blackface and that what was happening on opera stages around the globe was not. Further, it says, and I'm paraphrasing here, that not only was the practice of darkening skin for the stage not blackface, but that theaters should continue to do it because of its historical context, and that black singers need to worry about things that really matter. I was instantly infuriated, not just by the fact that I didn't agree with the notion that what Anna Netrebko was doing was not blackface, because I also believe that we are incredible people with the incredible ability to multitask. And just as I can focus on and call attention to systemic racism in the opera industry, I can also use my voice to tell you that blackface is wrong. In the comments of the post, there were not just black singers commenting with approval, but also white people in the industry saying they agreed with the singers' opinions on what is or isn't blackface. So I commented on the post with a comment that began, "Absolutely not. 100% disagree with your notion that darkening your skin on stage to appear as though you are black is not blackface. I went on to say that blackface is wrong both on stage and off, and that if opera companies want their Aida to be black so badly, they need to hire black women to sing Aida." Mm-hmm. To that, the other singer responded with something along the lines of, "You're allowed to have your opinion, but seeing as how I never met you, I don't need to care about your opinion." Mm-hmm. I responded basically saying that younger singers feel the way I do, but that he's right. Since we don't know each other, I wasn't going to comment any further. After that two-comment exchange, there was an onslaught of comments and messages from numerous people in the industry, none of them being positive. I was called disrespectful and told that I needed to chill out and be smarter about who I pop off to. It was implied that, unlike me, some of them actually walk the walk and talk the talk. 2 days later, I received a frantic phone call from a close friend of mine who was connected to a black singer in an administrative role at a major U.S. opera company. The friend shared screenshots with me of the administrator slash singer, saying that I had pissed off a very successful and powerful black singer by publicly speaking in opposition to someone beloved in the community. Unbeknownst to me, the singer that posted the original status founded an opera company with the mission to empower African-American artists. Additionally, I received phone calls in which it was explained to me that while I wasn't wrong, as a young emerging singer, I needed to be quiet and know my place. I was told that in order to protect myself and my career, I needed to write to every single person that felt like I disrespected the singer and plead my case to smooth the air. I didn't want to, but these men were literally dangling my career in front of my face. One of them could seemingly end my career in a heartbeat. This wasn't just an internet beef between myself and another singer like I expected. It had turned into much more. My career and my livelihood were in jeopardy. And for what? Because I dared to speak up and say what one of them was saying was wrong. I've spoken with a lot of singers since then about blackface and what seems to be an incredibly large divide between younger and older black singers regarding what we want to see in the industry. Older singers in general very much are still operating in the sense that we as a collective need to be thankful for our opportunities and strategic about where we direct our outrage. There seems to be a lot of fear that if we as black singers draw the line at blackface for Aida, then all of the black sopranos will be pigeonholed into only performing Aida and not getting to sing anything else. I honestly couldn't believe that I was having arguments over whether blackface is blackface with these singers. It seems that the singers closer to my age, I'm 26, stand more in line with me in the idea of darkening your skin to play a character on stage is, one, blackface, and two, absolutely despicable and has no place in the theater in 2020. Unfortunately, the louder, more established, more respected voices have gone on record saying the complete opposite, making it possible for opera companies nationwide to pretend that this is not a real problem and not something that needs to be addressed. Hope this shines a little bit of light on what's happening in the world of opera. It can absolutely be abysmal, but some of us are trying to make a change when we get the chance. Huge fan of the podcast. You remind me how important it is to maintain my voice in this incredibly white business. And I literally yell "Gunmark, Gunmark, Gunmark" multiple times a day to my friend's chagrin. All the best. This I love.
Can't help but think of Monique and her being outspoken. I'm always asking this question of what it means to be an artist with integrity. At one point, if you are a part of a production or an institution where you don't like something and it doesn't match with your aesthetic or your view of art or life, at what point do you just get up and just go and just sacrifice it? Right. Those are thoughts that kind of ran through my mind when listening to this letter. Like, so when are we going to continue to be silent? When are we going to stand up and take that risk or take that chance for a change to happen?
Right.
I feel bad for him.
Yeah.
Because I think he's absolutely right. Like, darkening your face to play a black character is blackface.
I mean, blackface. Unless you that you is literally what blackface is. Yes, and I changed the
unless you want to call it right. darkening face, but it's the same.
Just because it's brown makeup or brown paint doesn't yeah. mean it's not. It don't have to be
like
black.
Shoe polish.
It's less. Yeah. It's like just because it's not as out. Outrageously racist right. as yes. the face we just, know yeah. doesn't mean mm-hmm. it's not blackface.
Just
because
you didn't exactly. burn cork and put it on your face exactly. does not mean that yeah,
it's not even a microaggression. It's just racist.
Right. Like, also, blackface was an economic system. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? They built it so that black performers couldn't get jobs. That's right. actually why it existed. Mm-hmm. Because black people weren't allowed on stages. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So white people had to do that. And now we're basically saying, well, that's the way it's always been, so we still don't have to care about black performers not being allowed on stages. Right. That is you saying, minstrelsy is okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or like, because that's the way it's been.
It's so fucking weird. I also just don't understand why some white people have this obsession with like authenticity, but it's not authentic. Like, I honestly have no problem with you hiring a white person to play the Queen of Nubia in your imaginary whitewashed Aida, but just let her be a white woman
and don't do blackface.
And don't do blackface.
Right.
Like, high schools across America do hairspray all the time with all white people. I don't
they
know
do
how
whiz.
That is possible.
They
do the whiz. They do once on this island, and that's oh. Listen.
Choices.
And we all got to make them.
And you know choices. That, like, that theater teacher in that small town mm-hmm. was like, I just wanted to do good music.
Yeah.
You know why.
And justified in every way possible.
Listen. And it's nothing that we can do to stop it. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like, if you're going to do it with your white face on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don't right. do it with your black face
You don't
on.
Need to wear my face.
Yeah. Right.
Why mm-hmm. is it that you want to wear my face so bad?
Yes. That's so fucking weird. Like, why would I wouldn't even fit, like, I just don't understand, like, changing the melanin on, like, your foundation color. Like, how do you even go to the store and purchase this? Like, I need a B52. I know that I'm a W5.
but I just really want to be white today. So yeah. if you could give me.
And there are so many black, singers who could sing and do the role.
Mm-hmm.
So why not just give it to someone who can actually do the role? Mm. But it's that white privilege thing of like, oh, I want to do it, so I'm going to
do it. I do know that opera is based off of your voice. So like your vocal type determines the roles that you do.
Right.
And again, I mean, that's a system in itself. Mm-hmm. But what I don't understand is that like there was a comment in there like the black people are worried about if we make Aida a black role, then that means I'll only be able to do quote unquote black roles as a black opera singer. And I'm like, no, it could still be if I'm read that correct, because I was reading it as you were. But I don't understand why that vocal type can't just, if we're going to do multicultural casting across the board, because that's what y'all are doing, but just adding blackface to it for no fucking reason, then why don't we just eliminate the blackface? Do it like if you're a contralto or whatever, you do this group of roles, no matter what your race, and we just tell the story.
And that's also about fear, right? Like, that's like scarcity thinking. You're like, well, if we do that, then the whites will only give us this.
Right.
So we have to do this so that we don't anger the whites.
And I've experienced...
that's just like, we should all be joining together to get what we deserve and not worried about what white people are going to give us.
That's the thing.
And like, that's the problem.
I've experienced this with older black actors. There's a whole story behind this, but in grad school on the West Coast, there was an old, we were, the black students were saying, like, this is, we started noticing some things, but it seemed a little bit off. And so we called it to the attention of the administration and everybody. And we had an older black actor come in one of our, well, the person in power, the white person in power, brought in a black actor that they had worked with. And he basically came in and was like, I don't know what y'all are so upset about. This has been happening for I don't know how long, and it's not going to change, and it's fine. And basically, like, everything that we had said, like, completely undercut everything we had said. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, why would you do that? Like, you know, why would you? And then I guess it's just this mindset. It's like some of the older artists have not have been gotten so used to accepting what the leftovers that they don't know how to do anything else, or they're not comfortable doing anything else, which I try to have empathy for, but it's also like, my brother,
it's a generational divide.
It's like, 2020
for sure.
We know how to demand things, and our way of demanding things seems disrespectful to certain people. It's like, I remember when Me Too first started, the conversations, like, in the, you know, Me Too first started, in air quotes, whatever that means, because that has been
a thing.
Whatever that means, right? It's been a thing forever.
Just Adam.
But when we were having the conversation suddenly as a culture, I was freaked out by the older women that were like, I don't know what they're complaining about.
Yeah.
You know, men have been this way for forever. And I was like,
yeah,
girl,
it's wrong.
You got Stockholm syndrome or something.
Yeah.
Think about what you're saying.
Yeah.
And it is that people have had to learn to survive a certain way and they don't recognize it as a new way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just like ask for what you deserve. Just ask for it. It's okay.
And
you
don't
be okay.
Not want your kids. It's like the parents who be trying to put their kids. It's like if you ran away from slavery, like you gonna enslave your child because mm-hmm. you was a slave. You need them to learn all the lessons you learned as a slave. And it's like, nah, we's free now. Like, you don't need to, I don't need to be enslaved. I got in a conversation about income with some of my elders. Now, I did have to check myself because as you can see, I'm so passionate about mm-hmm. what I'm saying. Sometimes when I'm talking to my elders who do know more than me about the business, I just force and drive my point without really listening to mm-hmm. what they're saying. So mm-hmm. I did have to check myself, but I did end up saying, I'm like, listen, when we're talking about monetary worth, like millennials, we're all about like exchanging the information. How do I know my worth if I don't even know how money works? You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And you saying like, oh, well, he's worth that. And he's white. I'm like, nah, he comes from money.
Mm.
And they systematically as a people, like we literally pay white men more,
mm-hmm.
period. And black women always get shafted. Mm-hmm. And how am I supposed to ask for my worth unless another black woman doesn't sit and have a conversation with me?
Right.
I shouldn't have mm-hmm. to learn my worth as I go through the business and just be collecting pennies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can stop that. Like, I don't need to go through what y'all went through. Mm-hmm. That's my point. Like,
right.
And any younger black woman that comes into my show or that I'm just talking to about Broadway or talking about contracts or whatever, I'm always like, let's sit down and let's talk about this, and this,
mm-hmm.
because this is what they're getting.
Yeah.
This is what they're offering us.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they're offering, da 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 da, so that you can skip all the bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why it's so unfortunate with the old opera singer, like, you need to apologize.
Mm-hmm.
No, boo.
Mm-hmm.
Boo. Like, yeah. No, you don't need to. It's just absurd to me that older actors can think like, well, I went through it, so you must suffer as
right.
well.
This ain't like, what the fuck you talking about?
Like the hell?
Yeah. Well, do we have any words of advice for?
Oh, damn, we just talked
this young. No, I just want to bring, because I know that's hard, and the thing about it is like we all go through some version of this
mm-hmm.
as artists of colors. Of color. And so I just want
as
to
like of the folks. Rainbow.
Yeah. And so I just want to, and I think a lot of younger people that are in school listen to this, to mm-hmm. this show. And so I just want to make sure that we always uplift and encourage the artists that are coming up behind us. Because if you're not dealing with it now, which you probably are, especially if you're in a PWI,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're probably dealing with this, you know, right now. So mm-hmm. do we have any words of encouragement, things that they could do?
I mean, I always say, trust your intuition
mm-hmm.
and trust your sense of right and wrong, because you're probably on the right side of the conversation, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to be the person who's speaking out when everybody's trying to tell you you're wrong, but it's also important to keep trying, because there's somebody out there who agrees with you and they won't know that they're allowed to speak until you speak.
That's right.
Amen.
And sometimes, like when you're going through these circumstances, like for me, I can't speak for everybody else, but I think people can relate to that. You create these scenarios or these ideas of white people, and truth is, the person that you're dealing with directly may not be like that. And I found myself in that situation, being like the only black designer in the program, wanting to do black shows. Mm-hmm. You know, they already have a curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
There's only like one black professor. He's a lighting designer, and so I was really frustrated and like just really like discombobulated about the whole situation. And I realized it was all in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And when I opened up my mouth and spoke my truth and explained what I'm going through and what I need, they was there by my side to help support. And then we brung in people of color into the room.
Mm-hmm.
We had group conversations mm-hmm. with people outside in the industry that are working.
Mm-hmm.
So you also have to figure out what's all in your head and what's truth, and speak your truth so you can get to the other side.
Yeah.
I love that.
A professor of mine told me something I guess is a little fucked up. She's a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I was super militant in college. I was like, black power. Like, I was black, y'all, black, y'all. Like, so much rebel about a cause. Like, sometimes just like we be talking about, you know, sandwiches, and I'm like, and remember that I'm black. You know, like, it's just, it was a lot. And she sat me down, she was like, and I ended up getting, like, blacklisted from one of the musicals we did because of, like, my demeanor, my attitude. And I did have an attitude. I did have a chip on my shoulder. I was angry. Mm-hmm. And I think it was valid. Mm-hmm. It was valid, you know. And it was also my first time really being around white people in mass like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. And it's shocking.
It's shocking. Mm-hmm. It's shocking. And she sat me down. She said, listen, you got to learn how to play the game. And I said, ooh, what do you mean? She was like, you can have all your thoughts and all your feelings. She said, but this is a game. And she's like, you have to understand what you want out of it. What you personally want out of it, you know, and you can say things, but it's how you say it. You can say things, but it's when you say it, the time in which
timing
you say it,
everything.
Timing, who you say it to. You can't just dump all of your hurt and your pain, your anger and your frustration and even like your rightness onto someone who's not ready to hear it, because it's just going to fall on deaf ears and it's going to get you into a fucked up situation that you have to dig yourself out of. And so a lot of times I just think to myself, like, all right, I got to play the game. You know, I got to do what I have to do to put food on my table, take care of me and my daughter and get these. And now it kind of comes, you know, it's kind of fucked up advice because you don't want to have to mask it, you know. But then there are arenas like this now, thank God, in 2020 on the podcast. Like, I don't have to play the game here. You know, I don't have to play the game with my friends.
Right.
But when I'm at work at the Book of Mormon, you know, I'm pleasant and I'm playing the game and I'm being myself. I'm being my authentic self. But I've learned how to, you know,
negotiate
Monique and Steve Harvey balance.
Yes.
They both have like valid perspectives, but you gotta find a balance.
You gotta find the balance, and you also have to know who you are. I'm a black woman in the industry. You know what I'm saying? So me saying it versus a heterosexual black man saying something is going to be different.
Very true.
You know, am I looked at as a commodity in industry? No. You know, but black straight men a lot of times are. You know, white straight men are. So, you know, partnering with someone to say what you have to say is also really smart. But I mean, in this instance, it kind of sucks because the elder brought it to social media and you commented, and I think it was totally valid. I mean, he brought it to social media and you commented, which you have every right to do. I think that there was literally nothing you could have done to do this. There's nothing you could have done to improve the situation except for not comment, which I'm not going to say, oh, don't comment. Like, no, comment. You had to. You had to put that perspective on the thing, but they're just not ready to hear it. And that sucks. That fucking sucks. But I can guarantee that that's not going to prevent your career from moving forward. It's not. It's really not. And you also have all the receipts. So if it does, you have the receipts.
Yeah.
Police! Help!
No, y'all said everything.
Well, you know, I love these moments of silence. But anyway, you know, this has been a brand new episode of Off Book brought to you by Broadway Black. Drew, we love you. Please put money on his books.
We miss you, Drew.
We miss you. We know jail's a hard time.
Thank you for inviting me, Drew.
Yeah, from the jail. He wrote her. Anyway.
Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank
incredible.
You.
Oh,
this
all
is lovely.
The gems you were dropping. And
no, this is lovely. I got to do a lot of press, but this is good press.
Well, bye, y'all. Have a good week. That was aggressive. Bye, you guys. Have a great week.
Bye.
Today's episode of Off Book is brought to you by all the Natalie Portmans. Yes, all of them. You heard me right. You mean to tell me you haven't heard about all the Natalie Portmans written by C.A. Johnson? It's a fantastical new coming-of-age story about a smart and hyper-imaginative queer teenager named Kiana. C.A. Johnson is making her off-Broadway debut and been receiving good reviews, so look into it. You can catch it now at MCC Theater running through what? Must close March 29th. Limited seating available. Hold on. So we need, what? We won't get an extension? Dang. What is we waiting for? We need to get our tickets today, right now. Yesterday, I'm day at mcctheater.org.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical, Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.